Welcome to I Only Eat Hamantaschen, the only podcast where we only eat prune Hamantaschen. I'm John Darnielle, and I have a prune Hamantaschen from just down the street.
Well, welcome to Hamantaschen Talk. We used to make Hamantaschen at home growing up.
How is there not a Hamantaschen Talk podcast?
There is now, John. You're on it.
Yeah,
man. Get with the program.
Hamantaschen Talk. This one is prune. I believe prune is kind of the canonical Hamantaschen. Prune or raspberry, right?
Well, poppy is actually a real traditional flavor. It probably depends on what region you're from. Mm-hmm. I grew up with poppy being pretty traditional.
Ashkenazi or non-Ashkenazi?
I'm Ashkenazi, yeah. Mm-hmm. But it's also probably regional. Like, my family's Czech or Bohemia at the time. I grew up with making, and this might have been just like a bread-making family, we made yeasty ones. So these are like a little more pastry.
This is a shortbread one, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so we made more like yeast dough.
Right.
So it's like a much bigger outer side.
I think I probably already plugged the cookbook Olive Trees and Honey on the last season. It's a collection of Jewish recipes from around the world. And you learn these distinctions when you're baking or cooking with it. Like, some of these are shorter breads and some of these are yeasty breads. And the yeasty ones are real good, but the short ones are a whole different vibe. So.
Hi, I'm Joseph Fink, podcaster and novelist, and this is the show where I talk with John Darnielle, singer and songwriter of the band The Mountain Goats, about what it means to be a fan, to be an artist, and to be both at once. We are going song by song through the brand new Mountain Goats album, In League with Dragons. Today we talk about the song Younger, which at the time, before the album changed names, was the title track, but it still, in its own way, serves as a key for the rest of the album, right down to the origin of its chord pattern. All right, so this leads us, obviously and logically, into our song today, which is... So this is actually an interesting one, because this song changed names, and I'm not clear what the final one is. Is it called Younger?
Yes, it is.
Okay, because it used to be called Bitter Traces. Mm-hmm. And then the album is called Younger, mm-hmm. but it used to be called Hyenas at Night?
No, Hyena singular.
Oh, Hyena at Night.
And the thing about the album title Younger is it has quotes around it. I should even bring it up, because like... That's there for contemplation, not the author sitting there saying, well, here's why it has quotes around it, right? It's there to think about what does it mean to put something inside quotation marks. But the inspiration for that is my friend Roz's album Ashes that came out in, I think, 85, that had quotes around Ashes, and he wouldn't really explain to me why. But for years, I've thought that was interesting. It does something to a word when you put it inside quotation marks. And one thing it does, I think, is points out to the reader that there's a speaker behind anything that you read and that they may have their own ideas about the thing being said. And so might you, right? Everything has a speaker. There's a presumed speaker. But when we don't have quotation marks, when we have a narrator, often we sort of disappear the speaker and it becomes a voice of authority somehow. There's something necessarily authoritative about any writing, right? And so writing inherently asserts authority in some way. And quotation marks are one way of playing with that, of pointing out that you don't have to take anything an author says at face value, and you probably shouldn't, and that the author himself may or may not be spelling out all his own assumptions about a word. And Younger, I think, is a pretty loaded word. So, but yeah, it was called Bitter Traces. It was just it was its original thing, which is just a lyric, because I didn't have a title. I usually begin with a title. But I wrote this song in the basement of the Riviera in Chicago on tour. I know I was in a dark mood about something. I mean, I don't know if it was about something. I think I might have, you know, not every dark mood is about something in particular. But I really liked that it came out as images instead of a story. You know, there's a story in there, but it takes a little unpacking.
Which I think you could say about a lot of this album.
Yeah.
So it's a...
But like Cadaver Sniffing Dog that we did a little while back, that's pretty narrative. An emergency team arrives on the scene, mm-hmm. and describes the scene and says, well, this is going to take the dog. There's not going to be any live bodies in here, right? So I mean, that's what happens in that song.
Sure.
But yeah, in this one, it's hard to – I really like the movement of this song. It kind of satisfies this desire I have to be able to write something very evocative where the story is open enough that you can situate yourself in it from a number of angles.
The quotation to remind people – that there's a speaker reminds me of that great Ani DiFranco line, which is, was it, every song has a you, you that the singer sings to.
That's right. That's right. And actually, this is a song that Ani DiFranco was the demo. Well, you have a demo and pre-production and final on this, right?
I have we'll get to this, but I have a number of different versions of this one.
Oh, you probably have the soundcheck version too.
I have one that's labeled Primal Scream.
Yeah.
And I have one that's labeled Upstate.
Yeah, that's right. So Upstate refers to Ani DiFranco, right?
Okay.
Because that was the original rhythm.
drank that Simon High, drain the wellspring dry, map out your coordinates.
I have, let me look through, I might have others. Keep talking while I look.
Well, the rhythm, is there a guitar? You know, there's a bunch of guitars out in the hallway. There's no reason why. Could somebody bring me a guitar and then I will just, I'll show you what I'm talking about instead of saying dun dun, right? And in this podcast, we don't worry about the sounds of doors and stuff like that thing. Oh no, an acoustic. Sorry.
Let's see.
We don't go with that newfangled stuff.
I have this version.
Yeah, that's a demo. I think that might be the dressing room demo.
Yeah, this is labeled Bitter Traces 3. I have Bitter
No, that's home. It's a home demo.
I have Bitter Traces Upstate.
So that's after we got... Oh, no, that's my... It's another home demo with a reel from GarageBand.
Okay. Why Upstate?
Because Annie DeFranco's from Upstate.
She's from Buffalo. It's a real question whether Buffalo's Upstate.
To a person who has no skin in the game there?
Sure.
Is it New York City? And is it Westchester County? No? Then it's upstate.
I agree with you. There's a lot of question of, because I live like just a little north of Poughkeepsie. And so yeah. I often say I live upstate, and there's like people who will yell at me because I'm south of Albany. So yeah. Am I really upstate?
Yeah. No, I mean, the thing is, it was a quick labeling. So thank you very much. It's not like I sat down and went, okay, well, now what's the correct way to refer? I was like, well, it's Buffalo, but I didn't want to write Buffalo. That, you know, upstate sounds cooler. With all respect to Buffalo. But so the original went, well, the original actually didn't have that 7 in it. It was this. That right? And it was all that.
So it's just like a descending kind of bass line. Right.
And I wanted to play it a couple times to see if any Mountain Goats fans from way back understand how that informed the lyric. Then that changed to this when I got to writing the other, the more rhythmic, the... Right? And that just, tonally, that really broadens it out, and I think it complicates the lyric a lot, right? But the thing is, this... is this... is a chord progression from a song called No I Can't off of a tape called Transmissions to Horus.
Oh, sure.
A tape
okay.
that I made when I was younger.
You bought me some chocolates, and you bought me a rose, and you brought me a paper bag, and you brought me a lamp. Thank you. Chocolates.
And so that's what that is about, is the chord, the music. And there's a bunch of little jokes in this. Not, you know, jokes is a good word, actually. There's a bunch of little things in this record that are playing with that, right? With because I've grown musically. You're going to grow musically. Some people in every genre, there's people who sort of don't want you to grow. They want you to do the thing that you do, right? And that's fine. I get it. I mean, there's plenty of artists who I like for a long time. You know, Nick Cave is one. I love Nick Cave to a certain point. And then I'm no longer with him where he's going. I don't say that he's run out of ideas or anything because I know that's not true. He's just, I have less interest in his journey at some point, you know. And he still does stuff that like knocks me over from time to time. But you get pretty committed to most artists, you know, to their shtick for at some point. And then when they grow, people go, oh, well, you know, his earlier stuff was better. I'd go, yeah, it's usually not true, actually. Usually the later stuff is better in practically every way except that you don't relate to it as much. And so, which happens a lot, you know. But then depending on where anybody gets on, you know, it depends. There's plenty of people who joined the Mountain Goats around the time of the Sunset Tree, which for plenty of old school Mountain Goats fans was about 2 albums too late. And so, but I mean, the other thing is like, because life's long, you navigate these as long as you go. Like I have come back to later Psychedelic Furs. For a longest time, I was the first 2 albums purist. After the second album, I don't care, right? But then they did this amazing late career arc thing on a record called Book of Days, right? That was so good that it made me go, well, I should go revisit some of the earlier and some of the stuff that I had written off. And I had been wrong. You know, it was like, actually, no, they were doing interesting stuff. It just wasn't the first 2 albums, which had been such a powerful force in my life that I didn't want to hear. You know, they're popular stuff, but I have people who really rep for Mirror Moves. I need to dig deeper on that. But anyway, the music informed the journey of the lyrics by being this much more like this. At the time I wrote that one, That was actually a pretty complex thing for me to be doing. I was palm muting, right? That was new to me. And then to go, well, I couldn't have really done that at all in 1993.
Yeah.
And then even less so could I have gone, I would never even found that second chord, that seven there, or is it a nine? But yeah, so that's some of the growth of this song, is that it goes from being literally the exact chord progression I wrote when I was younger to what's the opposite of a ghost?
The opposite, I mean, a person?
This is more of a Socratic question. No, a person's the middle station. It's an angel, I guess.
Right?
It's not a ghost of the old progression. It's the angel of the old progression. Not perfected, but the version that it had to die to become.
One, two, three, and... Crank that siren high, drain the wellspring dry, map out your coordinates. Send out scouts by day, dole out mercenary pay for restless young subordinates. It never hurts to give thanks to the local gods. You never know who might be hungry. It never hurts to scan the windows on the upper floor. I saw a face there once before when I was younger. The torch aflame, call the night by name, stake out your dark position. Lie in wait by the gleaming city gate, try not to lose sight of the mission. It never hurts to give thanks to the broken bones you had to use to build your ladder. Moment close at hand, half of you will never understand, and it doesn't really matter. Big smile on my face, capsule just in case, underneath my tongue there. Voices in the breeze, I heard voices once like these when I was younger. Blood rushing to my I know that sweet warm taste and the bitter trace. Storm ride down that hill. If I don't, no one will. Follow me right through the chaos. This whole house is doomed. Even the bit parts get consumed. Prepare a grave for Menelaus. It never hurts to give thanks to the navigator, even if he's spitting out random numbers. I knew what those figures meant and what they hoped to represent when I was younger.
Are there other tracks on this album that started out playing around with older chord patterns?
Nothing that started out, but I keep noticing. This is the thing, because there's only so many notes in the scale, and because you're limited by your own, you know, just by your own having developed a style and stuff, you notice when you are not referencing yourself, but when you're falling into one of your old patterns. And if you're me these days, John Worster really helped me with this. Then you find some way you can mess with that, so you're not repeating yourself. So you're like, so many old Mountain Goats songs, this is the rhythm. And at some point after we made an album or two together, John Worster said, this is really good about some song, but this is in your default rhythm. I think I told this story last year, that you know this is in your default rhythm. Don't be sad about that. Every songwriter I've ever worked with has one. But there's only so much your drummer can do with your default, right? At some point he's going to – and once the drums are in, people will notice it's the same beat. Now there's things you can do around that with adding percussion or taking notes out, you know, and so forth. But it challenges me as a writer to always be trying to stretch to like see if I have a song that goes – what if instead I just play on the chord, right? And when I go to the D, what if I just go – I want that propulsion, but I can get that from the bass, or I can get it from a horn section, I can get it from a number of places, and maybe I can even go, I could, you know, give it a sort of an upswing, except that that's actually a song from the first full-length CD, right? Called Azos Leilia Tautikvok, right? And that's the thing, is you wind up in conversation with your previous work. There's a compelling case to be made that after the first thing that you write or make, everything you make thereafter is in conversation with that piece, and except that each subsequent thing is in conversation with all the stuff that came before it.
Do you think it's the first thing you make or the first thing that people pay attention to?
No,
you've always made, you know, you made things as a kid, presumably, right?
Yeah, no, I think to some extent the first thing people pay attention to was still in conversation with the stuff that they didn't, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, I do think you probably put a pin in the one that got you the charge, right? I mean, I think that is that's an inevitability. It's like the one that then somebody says, hey, give me more of that. I mean, for those of us who like to perform, that's cocaine, right? It's like you just go, oh, yeah, okay, I want to do that again. I want that response again, you know, many of us anyway. But I do think whatever that first stuff was, it was in conversation with probably in quite adversarial conversation. It was like angry at the stuff that hadn't gotten the attention, angry at the stuff nobody seemed to care about, you know, and there's a little of that informing every bit of it, right? But yeah, I do think eventually all of a person's work is in conversation with previous iterations of it. Because you are probably chasing down some ideas that if you could resolve them, you'd be free of the desire to make the work. Right? So,
I mean, I was thinking about this because so Meg and I went and saw the Broadway revival of Angels in America recently.
Right.
We actually watched it with Tony. Tony Kushner was sitting a few rows away from us. Andrew Garfield.
That's the guy on Monk, right?
Andrew Garfield, by the way. I had never really watched him anything. Incredible as prior. Like really way better than a celebrity on Broadway needs to be.
I want you to continue telling the story, but I just feel obligated to, because this has happened once during our tapings. Is like, I know that there's a thing that exists called Angels in America, and that's everything else you're talking about is utter mystery to me. None of these people.
Andrew Garfield, famous actor. He did a real good job with the acting.
Love to Andrew Garfield.
But the thing I was thinking about is Angels in America is almost at the moment it came out became this canonical work in American theater.
Right. No, I do know that about it, that it's giant. Right, so.
And, I mean, he's written a few movies, but Tony Kushner's really done nothing like it since. And that was early 90s he wrote it. And Meg and I were talking about that. And just maybe you only get one of those. You get the one that's, like, defining. And that's okay. Like, a lot of it doesn't need to be defining. It can just be work that's very good.
Yeah. I mean, definitive works always feel like such a, you know, it wouldn't matter what Gordon Gano did. That first Violent Femmes album is so iconic.
Sure.
That, you know, I know for several albums the Violent Femmes were like going, hey, we're still doing cool stuff. And everybody's like, add it up, add it. Like, you know, me too. Like I was there at the time and I bought the first one and like that was a life-changing record for me and for so many people. To be 16 in the summer that the first Violent Femmes album came out was to feel like here is a new piece of music that belongs to us. It was like a common coin. Everybody, you know, when that stuff came on at a party, everyone was there for it. You know, I played that thing down to the grooves. And the second one, Hallowed Ground, came out. And most people went, well, it's just not as good. And boy, I tried very hard to claim it was better. I really wanted it to be better. Well, it's a good record, but the first one has a special thing. There are a number of things in rock that are that way, where people don't seem to have been able to shrug off the burden of having made a first record that landed really hard. And that's why I recommend writing stuff that almost nobody likes for at least 7 years before you actually try to write stuff people will like. Okay, really, really, and you got to make the barrier for entry super high. You got to record your stuff while the TV is on, right? And when somebody tries to tell you, hey, I could fix that, fire them, right? You say, no, I don't want you to fix anything. And we're like, I had an engineer once trying to tell me, hey, there's a lot of phase on this. Do you want me to fix that? And I would say, no, so leave it the way it is. And well, to most people, phase is very unpleasant to hear, but I can't hear it. Right? Phase one of
the things. What is phase again?
For this, we have to bring the engineer in because
Vin,
I can't.
Can you get on mic?
Vin, would you please explain to our listeners what phase is?
The guy who's been mixing every one of these episodes you've heard is coming into the room. He's going through the airlock. Studios have airlocks. You can sit where I'm sitting.
We're going to talk about sound for a minute. Welcome to I Only Listen to Phase.
Sound is physical.
Yeah.
It travels in a wave.
It exists in space. You just can't see
it. Yeah. So when something is out of phase, the peak of one waveform is occurring during the valley of another waveform.
Right.
So phase is just the direction of the waveform, I guess.
Right. And when something is said to be out of phase,
right.
What's that? You have an ear for phase? You can hear it?
Sure.
And what's it sound like? What's the effect of that?
It's kind of a swishy sound.
Yeah.
It gets swishy.
So when MP3s sound all crushy and you notice that the waveform of it doesn't feel as big as a file, is that phase related or no?
Well, one thing that's happening with MP3s is that it's robbing the top end of information.
Right. Yeah.
So what you're hearing, like that like garbled sound, is actually just holes of information.
It's holes,
that are
missing
gone.
Pieces. Is so
like
crazy.
You hear a cymbal crash and it's like, has a little bit of a
thing.
It's just
because it's not the whole crash. It's just
not
the parts that your ear can maybe make, can call a crash when it hears it. Yeah, that's wild.
It robs most from the top end.
Yeah.
The MP3.
And that's what almost everyone is listening. Well, the AAC is slightly better, right?
I think so.
And high res if it's a 320 MP3?
Yeah. Also, MP3s feel like they sound a lot better now, right?
Yeah.
Like you get much higher quality MP3. You can
get 320s, but the actual straight, what's the normal? The older ones were 180s, right? Isn't that right?
I think the ones when it first started were like the iTunes sold probably 128.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I remember like back in I'm a millennial. We had like Kazaa in high school, and I remember ones being in like the 90s. Is 96 a number? 98?
Of course.
Yeah,
yes.
And those were garbage.
No, the 96s were terrible. I was getting a lot of Thai pop from websites where I couldn't read any of the characters on them, and those were all 96 kilobits per second. They were just crazy.
Yeah. And so the worst quality MP3s are ones which have been compressed twice.
Yes.
So if you take an MP3 and then recompress it at, say, a smaller...
Oh, I know. I've had to do that a couple times with Welcome to Nightfield Weather, and I really hate doing it, but occasionally people will only give me an MP3, and then I'm like, well, I'm going to have to recompress your work, and it's going to sound bad, but...
Welcome to I Only Never Transcode MP3s.
So I'm going to hop on the soundboard. Vin's going to take over hosting.
So yeah, with stuff that's out of phase, like we took some stuff to John Goldman. He was like, well, there's phase all over this thing. And I was like, you know, I can't hear it. And he said, yeah, some people can't. But once you hear it, you never unhear it. I no longer have any idea what our original jumping off point was, but I don't really care because I love to hear engineers talk about their stuff because it's so – it really points out to you that like how much has to go on for you to have the profoundly subjective experience of someone's music. You know, it's like it's so much bigger than you think it is. You know, and at the same time, so much more knowable. You know, it's like it's math. You know, it's science. It's not how somebody felt when he said something. It's literally the question of the velocity of air moving, you know, air and tone.
Well, it's also, talking to engineers reminds you, you know, because both of us in very different ways have found commercial success in manipulating sound.
Mm-hmm.
You don't actually have to know a lot about sound to do that. Like I even sound edit things and I still don't. I wouldn't be able to point out phase to you. Like the technical side of things is such a science that – you don't
many people shun learning about it, I think, because, you know, well, you got to stay, you got to focus on what you're actually doing. But like when we were making this record, you know, Matt Ross Spang was the engineer and he's totally amazing. And he was really, you know, Brandon Eggleston, who tours with us and is also an engineer for me, I'm always hitting with questions. And I love when these guys explain this stuff. It's like, for me, it's like talking to a magician who's like, in a world where magic actually exists, you know, and is like saying, oh, yeah, no, what you do is you put the scarf over the glass, and then you know these words that you say under your breath, and people don't hear them, and it causes a dove to appear inside the glass, right? And that's what they're doing is like, you know, talking about the different microphones and how they work and, you know, and slight differences in capsule, you know, which can be – there's some mics that look completely different. The SM7 is one. It's like it's very similar to, I think, a 58. Vin, is a 58 that the SM7 is almost the same capsule or is in fact the same capsule? No, he says, no, I feel like the SM7 is like shares a capsule with one of the Shures, with the 57 or 58. But to me, it sounds completely different, you know, when I hear it in mix. But then it's the other thing. When you're listening to it during tracking, it's different. You know, this stuff is very fascinating to me.
Yeah, I mean, it's a thing, I guess, you start – I mean, I definitely know a lot more about audio than I did 3 years ago, and you've been doing this since the early 90s. So, yeah. Like, even if it's not something you're trained in, just being around it this long, you start to – get opinions, you start to hear from people that know, and gradually you reach a point where you hate SM7s.
You know, I should actually for the – well, the reason I grew to hate the SM7 is precisely because it always sounds right when you're tracking and in rough mixes behind the board. You go, oh, that sounds great. And then when I hear it finally, it doesn't – for me, the presence of something that, you know, like an RE20, but almost anything else, for me – cuts through better. And that's one thing I want from a vocal mix is for not for the vocal to be mixed hot and high, but for it to cut through, for it to sort of occupy its own space. I feel like the SM7 plays really well with other instruments, you know, that like when you're trying to get a smooth, even mix, I feel like it sits well. But the RE20 that I like is a drum mic, right? That's what it's I think Stevie Wonder was the guy who said, let me use that on my voice. And it's also, it's a radio broadcast mic. That's the other chief application for it, I think. But yeah, I now want to write to Matt because he kept a list of all the mics I used. We did this record at Blackbird, and their mic locker is just bonkers. There's like a – I mean, because microphones, good microphones are very expensive, right? And so you go to a good studio and say, do you have a C20? And they will say, yes, we have two. At Blackbird, which is a huge studio in Nashville where, you know, it's owned by John McBride, who's married to Martina McBride. And there's like – it's a huge complex of studios. And you say, do you have a C20? And they go, yeah, we have I think we have 30 of those. It's like their mic locker is just bonkers. The Josephson mic we only used on Clemency for the Wizard King, but I really love the sound of that one.
I just want to take a quick moment to tell you about the cool I Only Listen to the Mountain Goats merch that is available to you. Do you like the logo of the show? Well, you can get it in one of its many colors on a shirt or tote. And you can also get a shirt that says, literally, I Only Listen to Podcasts About the Mountain Goats. Also available is the complete cover album we made last year, in which artists such as Craig Finn, Dessa, and Laura Jane Grace cover every track of All Hail West Texas. Find all of that now at IOnlyListenToTheMountainGoats.com.
So coming back to Younger, with something like Going Invisible 2, there was this real shift from demo to final, but
right.
It sounds like it was a shorter process, that it was like, this is what it'll sound like, and then you change your mind. With Younger...
We didn't even talk about it until we got to the session. With Going Invisible 2, we rehearsed it at speed, at my version, when we rehearsed as a band a few weeks or a month before leaving for Nashville. I was thinking, this one's going to be hard to get what I heard. Right, it's going to be hard to find because none of us are Tom Petty or Roy Orbison. It's like none of us were in the Traveling Wilburys, and it was a Traveling Wilburys sort of pastiche or a Jeff Lynne ELO pastiche. But yeah, that was a sudden in vivo thing where like she was playing, I started singing slowly. And we got time. What if we try it like that? And it was really good.
And with Younger, I mean, I would say I'm sure you'll disagree because there's a lot of nuance there. But I would say to my ear, the final isn't so far off from the
really?
Demo.
I think from the original demo. It's pretty far.
Yeah, I mean, this is where, like, the broad strokes of it are the same to me, but there was clearly such a longer process of winnowing with Younger because you have this demo version, you have a number of these different – you have the upstate and then you have the Primal Scream version.
Right.
What's going on?
That's a sound check version. So I had written this song – I write on tour a lot now, and I really enjoy it. And, you know, in part because I get depressed and – I mean, I used to think, like – I still kind of think that your best writing is probably done when you're in your best shape. But if you have a honed skill set, if you don't have to worry too much about am I getting my meters right and the music stuff, and if that stuff is a pleasant distraction from your interior landscape, and yet you have a discordant, you know, unpleasant stuff going on in your spirit or wherever, that can be a good combo. And it's a good way to distract yourself for a couple of hours, you know, so you don't sit there and soak in your own ill feeling. And so, yeah, so I write on tour, and I had written that one in the basement, like I say, the basement dressing room of the Riviera in Chicago. But I wrote it there, and I send things to the guys pretty quick most of the time. I was like, this one's going to be good. Yeah, this will be nice. And I think it was just a couple nights later, maybe one night later, I was like, hey, let's start playing. Let's, you know, we're not going to see each other for a couple months. It was Minneapolis, and it might have been the last night of tour. And I was like, let's see what we can do. Let's start looking at stuff. And John played this beat that was a Primal Scream style beat.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I could tell it sounded like a live thing. I assumed sound check. Part of the reason I knew it was a live thing is because the mix is so off in terms of instrument to voice.
Yeah.
Your voice is deeply buried.
You're hearing my monitors, right? I don't know if I'm even in my monitor at that point.
And then you, this was one of, I think, only two on the album that you've played live before recording this.
Two? I thought this was the only one.
Passaic.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Well, Passaic is its whole own story that we'll get to.
So you played this once in Alabama. You'd written in the notes you'd played it once in Alabama. And the weird thing about the internet is I could look up your Alabama playlist from the last year.
Right.
Somebody has, you know, been like untitled new song and then did their best to transcribe the lyrics.
Really? I didn't know those were there.
And then like leaving blanks because some of it was just, I guess, on the recording is hard to understand.
Yeah. Well, I don't know who has the recording because I don't think the recording is out there. I'm not sure if it is.
I'm sure someone on a phone or something.
Someone has it, but I don't know if it circulates. And that's for me, a very noteworthy difference if somebody has one versus does it circulate. But I did that. It was the opening number at the University of South Alabama, a show I really enjoyed because I just felt like it. You know, my least favorite thing about the age of the internet is you can't do that more often. You can't be workshopping songs live because then people hear them, and you want people to hear them in the audience, but you don't want them to really enter the broader conversation of your work. It'd be nice if they could just stay there for that night, but they can't. That's just reality.
I was gonna ask about that because you most of these songs you've kept kind of to yourself until
they're
recorded.
Well, yeah, you have to do that. So
yeah, and has that changed the process not being able to play this stuff live?
So we've talked about this a lot over the past 5 years. Transcendental Youth, we decided not to care. Transcendental Youth, we decided we're going to tour these songs before we record them.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And we played a bunch of them live. But for the most part, I mean, it's something you have to be thinking about. You have to tell your people. It's like, okay, well, I'm going to play a new one this night, you know, which I usually write my set lists 15 or 20 minutes before I go on stage. So, I mean, they share a lot of songs from night to night, but I don't have a printed set list that we go, this is what we're doing tonight, you know? So, but yeah, no, that's one of the, for me, the major downside for me just personally is like, I used to always play new songs. I couldn't stand to play a set without some brand new stuff in it, right? I hated, you know, and especially the first night of tour, oh, I got to play five. You can look at German set lists from me and Peter in 95, right? Half the stuff on there is on nothing, right? Mm-hmm. I'm just playing new stuff. And to me, that's exciting, right? But it's not exciting if everybody in the whole world can hear it the next day. Then it's boring to me, right? Then that's like all the electricity of sharing something that's unique to the room. Some people describe that as an elitist tendency. I don't think that's true. Things can be special for small groups of people without being elitist, right? I have a family meal. That's very pleasant. If everybody in the world comes into the house, then it's not the same thing, right? It's like there's a intimacy is a value, right? And the internet has had a giant impact on the general concept of intimacy, and it's in the concert venue is one of those places.
The monologuist, Mike Daisy, I remember once had a thing, and I forget which show. I've seen him perform a number of times. But he was talking about part of the appeal of theater is the fact that most people can't see it. That when you do a work of theater, the only people who are seeing that performance are the people in that room. And that's – if you didn't see it, you didn't see it.
Yeah. No, that's the nature of theater is ephemeral. Right? And it's really – you can't even film it. It's not the same.
No. I mean that's – you know, we do these Welcome to Nightville live shows and we're constantly being asked by promoters and stuff, do you have footage? And we never film it because in our experience, live theater never ever translates to video. Something that is gripping and magical in person, you put that on a screen, even filmed well, and it just looks flat.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's they used to, I mean, there are films made of great productions, but those are their own things, right? They say, today is the day we're going to film it, and we're going to do this. We have multiple camera angles and stuff like that. So
yeah, I mean, you need someone who, an experienced director who knows what they're doing. It's one of these difficult issues because it does feel like it probably constrains you not being able to play this stuff, but also there's no way out. There's no way to be like, please stop this entire ecosystem of recording.
Yeah, there's really no point in getting mad about it. I mean, the thing is, like, people know I hate being filmed. I mean, I hate it, right? But is there any point at all in complaining about that? No, you're not going to change people's desire to film it. No one really cares how you feel. And that's fine because I'm not there, as I said in the previous episode. It's not for my feelings that I'm up there. I'm there to provide something for people who have paid to see it, and hopefully they get what they want. You know, that's really important to me, to be pleasing the people who are in front of me in some way. I'm not there to say, here, help me have an experience that I enjoy to some extent, right? I mean, I'm also mindful of the people who are next to these people. I think it's probably not the most fun thing in the world to be standing next to somebody who's like trying to hold their arm real steady and looking at their phone. And that's the thing. If you say, this is a new song now, you will see a bunch of cameras go up. That I have a real bug in my ear about, or well, the proper phrase is bug up my ass. But because the first performance of a song will literally never be the best performance of that song, or even a particularly good version of that song. It will almost never have anything interesting about it, except that it was the first time, right? Mm-hmm. The song will absolutely, I'm willing to say this is an absolute. There's never been a first performance of a song by any artist that was the best one of that song by that artist, unless he never played it again, right? But
maybe this wasn't the first time. I think it was, though, the version of Purple Rain that ended up in the album was him debuting it at live in a club, and then they punched it up in the studio.
But I bet he played it a lot better later on. It was the version for the album, right? That was, and then it had an energy. But I would be willing to bet that on the Purple Rain tour, it reached heights. Because that's the nature of performing a song, is like you do at some point. This is making me feel weird because like I just made up the set list for the next tour, and Peter observed there's no goths stuff on it. I was like, well, yeah. I mean, we played 100 shows last year, didn't we? I kind of don't want to. If I got to play Eldritch again this year, I know what I'm going to do, you know. And then I'm thinking, yeah, but I listen to the Grateful Dead a lot. Yeah. Those guys were not – they played Me and My Uncle. Who knows? Well, you do know. If you go to headyversion.net, you can count exactly how many times they played every song. And so then I think of it as a personal failing as a musician that I can't stay engaged, or as a songwriter maybe. But for me, freshness is a thing, you know. But most songs, the first version of it played – Prince is also an outlier because of his perfectionism but is not going to be any good at all, right? It'll be okay at best. And people like have this weird, like, it's very much an authenticity fetish, like that there's something special in the first performance. And the only special thing is it's the first time you're hearing it, right? That's what's special, is like you suddenly, if you're a fan of the artist, you now have to be listening hard to hear what's going on. You have to suddenly engage the reader part of your mind in a way that you don't if you're hearing a song you've already listened to a dozen times and sung for yourself. But it stops me from playing as much new stuff as I wish I would like to. I would prefer to be playing more new stuff live.
And how does it affect for these two songs that you'd played live? I mean, this one you'd only played once.
Yeah. I played it once. I don't even remember why. I think I just wanted to make it special because not many people play down in South Alabama in Mobile, and I really like it down there. And so, when I'm playing a place I don't get to go often, I want them to have something special. And I thought, that would be cool, play something brand new. Nobody's ever heard it. And so I did that.
How does it affect the recording, if it does, deciding how to record it for the album, having played it in front of an audience?
That didn't at all. Okay. The pre-production is much more important for that, is what you – I keep threatening to talk more about pre-production, so now is a good time.
Great.
Pre-production is a profound luxury that most bands don't have, but that used to be very standard. And what it means is you go into a studio that is usually a much cheaper studio than the one you're going to record the album in. And you do dry runs at recording what you're going to do, because recording with multiple people, there's so many things to account for that we could have a whole running podcast about. What's it mean to go into a studio and make a record? You know, what are you doing? Are you taking with the Mountain Goats demos recorded by one guy and then translated to other people who don't have that much of a chance to play together outside of touring the studio and so forth? But once you get in the studio, often people track bass and drums first, together, right? But some producers, Roy Thomas Baker, right? The guy who produced Bohemian Rhapsody and The Cars. I think he does drums and guitar first, which is like weird to me. But there's a number of ways to do it. You can record it live. Many people prefer to do the vocals later. I like to often be singing live if I can, though I would prefer to be singing without playing. But then many producers, Tony Dugan from Tallahassee, says, it's better when you're singing and playing at the same time, which I thought was a weird. I bet you Bell and Sebastian doesn't do that, who he also produced. But for me, that was the way. And you do get a little less, I get less self-aware if I'm playing and singing at the same time. So then you can probably get a more in the groove. It can be hard to find that groove when everybody's done their parts and you're trying to land on top of them, right? But in pre-production, you get to try all this out. Let's do a version where I'm playing and singing at the same time. Let's do a version where I'm not. Let's do a version on a Fender Rhodes. Let's do a version on the piano. Let's slow it down 2 clicks. Let's speed it up 5 clicks, right? And pre-production is just doing, you could do it as a reggae number, whatever. We don't do that, but pre-production versions are the ones where you're feeling your way through. So when you do show up at the studio that's costing a ton of money, you have some experience of it. Now, if you do pre-production outside of the producer's presence, he might, when he gets there, say, okay, well, I listened to your pre-production version. I don't think that's the direction at all, right? And this happened a few times here. But yeah, it was for us, we haven't always, it's taken me 20 years to get to a point where I'm going to say, look, I'm going to spend my own money on some pre-production versions so that we can spend time in the studio feeling our way through this and then not be having battles, right? Not be going, okay, we got to do this one. This could take forever. So we did pre-production on Strychnine. We did it on Doc Gooden. We did it on Younger and Passaic, right? Because when we get to the Passaic episode, which will totally be the most interesting episode of this podcast.
So just skip ahead.
It's a side two number. You really won't understand what we're talking about until I get there, unless you've listened to the other episodes several times over delicious meals from Blue Apron.
If they don't sponsor us, we'll just bleep that out.
No, I must insist. You can, please, if you do bleep that out, just change the color. Like have somebody who sounds nothing like me say, delicious meals from Yellow Apron. So pre-production, I mean, it's really amazing because you really get the luxury of saying, well, we spent 4 hours doing this and that's where we went. That's what this, and some of the decisions are so capricious to put a clavinet on Passaic to, you get to try out a bunch of stuff. Right. And then in Owen's case, he would say, this is all really interesting. And I want everybody to pick what they're going to play and play that instead of trying out all these different looks during one song. Right. I want you to play. There was a bunch of piano over the pre-production version of Younger, I think when it was called Bitter Traces. And I liked some of those piano passes pretty nice, but they were from a jazz space. I'm not a good player, so they're not proper jazz, but they're like jazz. And Owen was just not interested in that at all. I will probably try and task Matt with bringing some of that back when we play it live. We haven't yet decided about that because he plays sax at the end, but that sax is not elsewhere in the song, I don't think. But he does do that sax solo. Is one of the most amazing.
Yeah, let's talk about it. It ends with...
I was there. I was there. That was so... I mean, Matt Douglas has changed my life musically. You know, he says, I love him to pieces. And we communicate on this level that, I mean... I get very emotional about it. It's like this, our musical communication is profound to me. And both of, I mean, my dad, as I've talked about before, played jazz. And so I was raised on listening to that stuff. After I was 5, I was only hearing it when I would stay with dad. But still, dad talked to me a lot about jazz. The last time we spent time, I was asking him to tell me to give me lessons because he went through this period of his life where he decided he wasn't a good enough player. And he became sort of a devotee, like in an almost religious sense, of a teacher named Gene Confer. He was practicing 6 hours a day. I was so resentful and angry at the time. It was my summer with my dad, and he would be just practicing in Autumn in New York. That was the song he was trying to get perfect. And, man, I did not want to hear it. It wasn't that he was neglecting me, because it was usually like after I go to bed, I hear him practicing for 2 or 3 hours. Da-da-da-da-da. da 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 da. He was checking the legato. He was checking the diminuendo. He was everything. Da 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 da. And voicings. I was like, oh my god, my god. But I learned about voicings and about sculpting, about less is more, about getting out of the way of the tune. And Matt went to school here at NYU and is a jazz guy, and you know, did the thing where when you're studying jazz in New York, you're going to shows all the time. You're sitting in all the time. And when we'd done the track, I forget, he plays on the basic. The basic has like everybody playing together. I forget what I think he's playing one of several guitars there. But I forget who first had the idea for sax solo at the end. But as soon as somebody said it, I was like, solo, an actual solo. Yes, we got to do this. And he laid down, I think, 5 or 6 different takes. And we were all going progressively more and more ape for every one. But I think that is take 2. I think it's take 2 with a minor fix somewhere. And it is, I'm in awe of how wonderful it is. It's just so good.
It's interesting because the last time we were talking about a guitar solo, that was take 2.
Is that right?
I wonder if it's a thing of you get progressively wilder. And that's really cool. But at a certain point, you're like, the one that was second most wild is the one that works.
The thing is, I mean, I think it's I'm a big original energy guy, right? My demos, what's good about them is you're hearing it so fresh. Like, I don't know how to sing it yet. I'm reading from a lyric sheet. I'm still finding my way around. There's going to be some accidents, and some of them are going to be good. But the thing is, all of his solos had much to recommend them. The question is, which one fits in the track best, right? I mean, like, they were all good. But, I mean, seriously, we were jumping up and down. These are experiences that can't be shared, really. Like, you try to talk about them, but if you weren't in the room, it's hard to understand how, you know, we're just sitting there, you know. And we've been studio days for 12 hours, right? And so I think this is like an hour 10 of day 3 or 4, you know, or even 5. To find yourself when you're working these 12-hour days continually going, it's hour 10 of the 5th day in a row, and I'm still discovering how much I love music. It's a miracle. It's a miracle. And that's solely, it's my single favorite thing on the record.
Thanks. capsule just in case, underneath my tongue line. Voices on the breeze, I heard voices once like these when I was young. Blood rushing to my face, I know that sweet warm taste and a bitter trace. Storm right down that hill, if I don't, no one will. Follow me right through the chaos. This whole house is doomed, even the big parts get consumed. Prepare a grave for men and things. It never hurts to give thanks to the navigator, even when he's spitting out random numbers. I knew what those figures meant and what they hold to represent when I was younger.
In League with Dragons is out now. Buy it. The Mountain Goats are also on tour throughout the year. Go and see them. We have two new Welcome to Night Vale episode collection books out right now. These are fully illustrated with a ton of behind-the-scenes commentary. It's a great way to try out the show. Another great way to try out the show is to listen to it. I Only Listen to the Mountain Goats is a production of Night Vale Presents with Merge Records. It is produced by Christy Gressman, editing by Grant Stewart, mixing by Vincent Cascione. All music courtesy of the Mountain Goats and Merge Records. Thank you to Christina Rentz, Ryan Madison, Seaside Lounge in Brooklyn, and The Rubber Room in Chapel Hill. Check out nightvalepresents.com for more information about this show and all of our other shows, like Start With This. Ready to make your own art? Or just lost track and haven't made any of your art in a while? Not sure where to start? Start With This. Each episode, me and my Night Vale co-creator, Jeffrey Craner, discuss a different topic in making art, such as collaboration or feedback. Then we give you two assignments, one to consume and one to create. Start making your own art, one easy assignment at a time, with Start With This. Thanks for listening, and hail Satan.
Hello, iPod broadcast listeners. My name is Meg, and I am one of the esteemed tri-hosts of the beloved iBroad Good Morning Night Vale. I, along with my hilarious friends, fellow Night Vale actors, passionate eaters, and soft-hitting journalists, Symphony Sanders and Hal Lublin, are now over 100 episodes into our deep dive recap show of Welcome to Night Vale. We've tackled topics like soft meat crown headcanons, Cecil's fashion, and whether Steve Scones were really all that terrible, plus behind-the-scenes stories from the Night Vale creative family. And we've heard from listeners like you about queer representation, Night Vale named pets, major theories, minor questions, and of course, best and worst practices for alternative spa therapy services. If you know, you know. Check out Good Morning Night Vale every other Thursday, wherever you get your eyebrows, eyecasts, pod broads, and podcasts. I think I like pod broads the best. I'm a real pod broad myself.